Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up, should school start sooner?
So to me, it's about an equity issue. I want my students to be afforded the same powerful learning opportunities that students in the private and charter school sector are here in the community. My kids are taking the same state test, the same advanced placement test, at the same dates that they are, yet they've had 2 more weeks or more of instruction than what my students were getting. And 2 weeks can make a sizable difference.
Why more and more schools are asking for a waiver so they can start before Labor Day. But first, joining us as they do most Fridays are Susan Demas, publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican legislative leader. The legislature gets back to business next week after its 12-week summer break. That's a lot of parades and barbecues. And it's an election year, so how will that affect what gets done? Susan?
Well, because it is an election year, I wouldn't expect that there's going to be too much action. They'll be in for a few days before November 8th, and that's about it. As far as the big issues that are still out there, I think we can pretty well expect that most of them will wait until the lame duck session after the election.
Ken, I know in past years, you know, the budget might still be an issue, but this legislature for the past several years has been able to, or the last couple of legislatures, I should say, have been able to get a budget together on time. How does that change things?
Well, getting the budget done in early June over the last several years is certainly a feather in their cap and a feather in Governor Snyder's cap, and they talk about that a lot, and they should. But the fact of the matter, and Susan's right, it's an election year. They're going to be in for a few days in September, but then they take another break for October in the election, and it's really going to be this late November, early December lame duck time when anything major gets done. And there might be some big things like energy policy, some criminal justice reform. I don't think we've heard the end of this recent revelation about Detroit schools and none of them closing. So it could be a pretty active late November, early December.
One of the issues that's in the news right now is the state school board's optional guidelines regarding gender identity in bathrooms. The board says transgender students should use the bathroom and locker room that fit their identity. We've already heard some legislators talk about this issue. This sounds like an election year issue to me. Will we hear anything about it while they're in town?
I'm not sure that they're really going to want to touch that. We're now in the general election season, and that's a pretty hot issue. That issue was really raised by Senator Tom Casperson, who is running for Congress in a highly competitive Republican primary, where taking a far-right stand is oftentimes necessary to win. Putting the marginal members of the legislature in a position where they would have to vote on something like that, I would question the wisdom. So I'm not sure that that is an issue that we'll see before November 8th.
One more thing I want to ask you guys about, and that's with the legislature back in town and it being an election year, how much time will the legislators be spending at fundraisers?
Well, it is an election year, and you know there are certainly fundraising events that happen almost every day. It's somewhere in the state, especially here in Lansing. We're going to see an awful lot of money spent in some of these highly contested state house districts, so I think we can expect business as usual on that front.
Ken, does this amount to getting down to Lansing so they can get involved in some of these bigger fundraisers rather than the coffee clutches that we see around the district?
Well, you asked how much time will be spent on fundraising, and the answer is a lot. It's an election year, as Susan pointed out. The other phenomenon really is term limits itself has dramatically increased the amount of time and energy and effort spent on raising money because seats turn over so rapidly. They're going to be spending a lot of time on raising money right from now till, hey, when the clock strikes midnight the day before the election.
Is this simply because of the legislative churn that they have to raise more money? I'm not sure why term limits affects that.
That's part of it. It's because the swing seats are in play every 6 years now in the House, every 8 years in the Senate at least. The sort of institutional fundraising that the caucuses and the parties do has gone up dramatically too. But yes, it's really the legislative churn or turn, as you phrased it, that drives up the time spent raising money.
And I suppose since Ken outlined a handful of issues they might tackle right now, all the fun's going to be delayed until we have lame duck session, it sounds like.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, this energy policy, there's some chatter that maybe the Senate will advance something in September and sort of get it poised for action in the House and final action.
Tell us quickly what that is. Is that the competitive electricity companies from outside being able to offer cheaper rates?
Well, but it's more comprehensive than that. It's the market structure and also the issue of how much renewable energy is going to be put in the mix.
And I mean, we've been talking about this for a long, long time. Why is it taking to the very end of a two-year session to finally get to it?
Because it's controversial.
Susan, anything you think you'll see in the lame duck that you know nobody else is expecting? Or I guess what is the big controversy you think we might see at the in the lame duck session?
I think that Ken is right that the energy package is going to be a big one. There's always talk about getting rid of no-fault insurance, but the votes are always short in the House, no matter how strong a Republican majority they seem to have, but I would expect a push. I think the agenda of lame duck depends very heavily on what happens on November 8th. If Democrats are somehow able to win majority, which would be picking up 9 seats, I think there will be a rush for a lot of very partisan conservative legislation in lame duck, because that will be the last chance.
Wouldn't be the first time we've seen that. That's Susan Demas. She's the publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. If you miss any part of today's show, you can find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcasts to find the link.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
So Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings is here. And we usually bring you a cocktail at this time, but you've been talking about different spirits in Michigan. Lots of distilleries these days.
Right. And we've used rum and gin and whiskey that's been made right here in Michigan. But there are some spirits that are tied to a particular region of the world and that we can't make here in Michigan.
Right. You think wines like Bordeaux or Champagne, but there are spirits too.
Right. So tequila has to be made in Mexico. So there aren't any Michigan tequilas, but today I'm going to take you to Lopez Tire Repair in Detroit for tequila with a Michigan connection.
Let's go.
So we're here at a tire shop in Detroit. How do you get from there to tequila?
Well, my father was raised around the agave fields back in his hometown in Arandas, in the ranch called Las Cruces.
We should mention that we're talking with Antonio Lopez, who's talking about his father, Silverio. The family is making and bringing in Cabresto tequila.
He originally thought of calling it Tequila Silvestre or Silverio, like his name, but it was already taken. So he came up with Cabresto. Cabresto means a horse's bridle.
So tell us about how this tequila is made.
Our tequila is made with our blood, sweat, and tears. My dad goes down to Mexico every 2 or 3 months, goes tends to his babies, his agave plants. He gets down and dirty with the actual humidors. All that loving he puts into it comes out to these great piñas. And once he harvests it, he takes it to the distillery where they go through the laborious process of fermenting it, cooking it, and ultimately distilling it and aging it.
Where can people get this?
Like I tell everybody, we're not in a whole lot of shelves, but if anybody wants to try it out, ask for it at your local liquor store. That would actually help us put it on the shelf.
So we've got a Detroit family who owns land in Mexico, growing the agave, and they're distilling it and bringing it to Michigan and trying to make a go of it here. So we always make a cocktail. Can you make a tequila cocktail for us?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that I really liked about the extra añejo tequila that we tried is that even though it's been aged for 7 years, it still has a lot of great tequila flavor. Sometimes when you get those older tequilas that have been aged like a whiskey, they kind of just taste like a whiskey. It's all wood. This still has a lot of that agave flavor. So I wanted to use it in a cocktail that would really show that off.
And what cocktail is that?
I'm using it in the old-fashioned cocktail.
So old-fashioned, that's usually a whiskey cocktail.
These days, yes. But while we call all sorts of different things cocktails today, historically, cocktail meant a very specific thing, and that was just a spirit with bitters and sugar. And so it could be any spirit at all. Whiskey's the most common these days, but it's a great way to show off an aged, older tequila.
What's in it? How do you make it?
Old-fashioned is one of the easiest drinks to make. Put the ice right in the glass that I'm going to drink it in, a rocks glass or an old-fashioned. Put a little bit of simple syrup. I used half an ounce. You can adjust the sweetness to your taste. A couple dashes of Angostura bitters, and then just a couple ounces of the tequila. Gave it a good stir, squeezed an orange twist on top to give some nice bright aroma when I sip it, and then you're done.
All right, well, let me give it a taste and see what we have here. Wow. Well, it tastes like an old-fashioned, but it's got that tequila right up front. You can really taste it.
That's right. It's a really good avenue for something that is really meant to be a sipping spirit on its own. So we didn't do a whole lot to it. We just kept it simple.
Well, that was a fun trip. I learned a lot. I hope we can do it again.
I hope so, too. Cheers.
Coming up, how much of college tuition goes toward subsidized athletics? At schools such as Eastern, Western, and Central, it can be more than $1,000 a year.
There is not enough market for the entertainment provided by these secondary schools.
That's in 20 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. School starts next week. This year, the kids will be spending a few more days in the classroom. We've got Brian Davis on the phone to talk about that. Dr. Davis is the superintendent of the Holland Public Schools. How many more days are added to the school year?
There are five more days added to this school year, going from 175 to 180.
And where are you picking up those extra days?
Holland Public Schools, after looking at the different options, decided to pick up those days with the pre-Labor Day start. We could have extended the school year well into mid-June, depending upon how many days we might have to make up due to inclement weather or snow days. We looked at the option of taking days off of spring break, our traditional holiday breaks, the day before Thanksgiving, and also giving up our professional staff development days, which we can't do because we have requirements to meet under state law for staff development. And so we looked at a pre-Labor Day start. A lot of people that would say, you know, oh, if you do this, you're not going to have people show up. We had over 90% attendance every day pre-Labor Day. And one of ours was because we announced early enough for parents to make their plans. And we did waivers for any family who had travel plans prearranged. We didn't have any issues by and large. We did very well with that.
Now, you have to get a waiver to do that, and more schools are asking for a waiver to start before Labor Day. That started becoming a trend before we had these additional 5 days of school. Why is that happening?
I think it's happening because there's increasingly greater accountability and transparency for school performance. I think that now with the curriculum changes that we have more and more content and learning experiences that we have to provide for our students. And we're also looking at our changing demographics across the state, and the research is well documented in terms of summer slide or summer loss. And so as kids leave school in early June and don't start until after Labor Day, in this case it's a late start for those starting after Labor Day, that summer loss is well substantiated, and we want to make sure that students are retaining the information they've learned the prior year and trying to increase that academic success.
I want to talk about why we start after Labor Day. I mean, this has been around for about a decade. The tourism industry had this law passed. They said it was put in place to encourage more vacation time in the state, and they say it's working. If schools start earlier, it could cut into some prime tourism season. You're a destination site there in Holland. What's the discussion like in your city?
You know, those are great questions, and I would like to dive deeper and have more of that data from the tourism industry provided to us in terms of who is actually traveling during those last weeks in August, because most school activities are already well underway. It may be hotel rooms filled up with individuals from out of state. I'm not sure it's people from Holland, Michigan, traveling to some of these other destinations in the state. For example, we had our second home football game last night. About 40% of our secondary students are already back engaged in school activities. Families are already back. And the tourism industry is very seasonal in our state. So while individuals may say my hotel rooms aren't filled up in August or July, if we're going to have to cut down on our holiday breaks in Thanksgiving and December, then you're impacting other tourist industries that are based upon that and the ski lift resorts and things like that. Bottom line, somewhere we have to add more days to our calendar. We're not adding more days to our annual calendar of 365 days a year, so it had to come from someplace. My argument also is that most universities have started before Labor Day as well. So that argument held true across the board. Why are our public universities allowed to start 2 to 3 weeks before Labor Day also?
Right, and you have a lot of schools have advanced placement classes. You have to work, coordinate with those colleges and universities. How do you manage that with this post-Labor Day start when you did that?
That's a great question, too, and it also brings up an issue of equity. You know, charter schools across our state, in many cases, are allowed to start pre-Labor Day. Many of our private schools have started before pre-Labor Day. All the other schools in my city district that I have, except for one, that are charter schools or private schools, have been starting pre-Labor Day for a number of years. So to me, it's about an equity issue. I want my students to be afforded the same powerful learning opportunities that students in the private and charter school sector are here in the community. My kids are taking the same state test, the same advanced placement test, at the same dates that they are, yet they've had 2 more weeks or more of instruction than what my students were getting. And 2 weeks can make a sizable difference. University of Michigan has their first football game tomorrow. Let's say instead of playing who they are, they were playing Michigan State, and Michigan State got 2 extra weeks of practice on top of Coach Harbaugh. I think the football community, the fan community, the college community would really have concerns about that. I wonder why we don't have that same concern over our K-12 education. We need to make sure that our students are well prepared, that they're doing well. The other piece is we align with our colleges here in Holland with our early college high school. And we have over 250 students enrolled in an early college high school program, and they're already back to school because our local colleges are back to school. We need to make sure that those services are all aligned together.
I want to talk about, you talked about placement tests. I want to talk about the M-STEP results this week that were released. It was pretty dismal results. Michigan as a whole is behind, and there's been more and more talk about year-round school, not just in an extra 5 days, but a lot more school. How do you think that's going to play out?
There's a difference between the year-round school and with 180 days that we currently have, or a year-round school with a 210 days. You know, the more appropriate term I think to use is a balanced calendar. Do you take the same number of days that you have in the calendar now and break it up very differently across the board and have different increments of time? They usually run in 8 to 10 week windows, and then you have a couple weeks off. Having had some conversations with members from the tourism industry, there is some favorability to move to a schedule more like that. I actually, as a superintendent who has done some research and study of that, would be very much in favor of a balanced calendar. The challenge with it is every community entity has to come around that and be in support of that. Because we're in a very seasonal state, there's a lot of summer activities that are built around our season. So in Holland, by way of example, we have all kinds of summer recreational programs. It's not that they still couldn't occur, but we would have to realign when those different activities were offered to align when school was in session. It can be done. I've talked with some of our local partners about what would that look like if we went there. But I think it requires an entire community to do that, an entire regional community to do that, because there are going to be some families that don't like it. And in a highly competitive choice environment where parents choose to go to school or not, I would hate to lose students out of Holland because we're in a balanced calendar. They didn't want that to go someplace else, and then that impact my overall budget.
That's Brian Davis. He's superintendent of Holland Public Schools. And welcome to the new school year.
Thank you. We have 7 days under our belt already. It's been a great school start. And we did, in respect of our change in calendar this year and try to balance out some of those travel pieces, students aren't in session today. We had a nice long Labor Day weekend and trying to balance that out. And we're looking forward to kids coming back on Tuesday.
Well, good luck with it. Thanks very much.
Yes, thank you. Have a good day.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Governor Rick Snyder's proposal to privatize all or part of the mental health services funding has been in the news lately. The governor has suggested $2.4 billion be shifted to Medicaid HMOs rather than public mental health organizations, according to reports in Crain's Detroit Business. Lieutenant Governor Brian Calley has been heading up discussions with a work group of public mental health agencies and advocacy groups. But it appears those talks have had some problems lately. Joining me to talk about that are Kevin Fisher, president of National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, and Don Hoyle, director of public policy of the ARC, an advocate organization for those with developmental disabilities. Let's start at the beginning here. How long ago did these talks with Lieutenant Governor Calley start, and what was the goal?
The talks with the Lieutenant Governor began shortly following the release of the budget language, which talked about switching funding over from the current system to going through the health plans, the HMOs. And that group met five times. The current meetings are a different animal, and they were subsequent to the recommendations of the original Lieutenant Governor Calley's group, and we were going to work on some different things. We thought we were being convened to continue the same work in a smaller group.
So what was the goal originally of the talks with Lieutenant Governor Calley and the Department of Health and Human Services?
Well, I think the original goal was obviously our opposition to the governor's proposal in the 2017 budget that would potentially privatize community mental health as we know it now. And so with that, we made very public our opposition. You're aware that there were public hearings held, I believe, back in February, March, and that, of course, spurred the initial 298 group that was approximately 124 people and now pared down to the group referred to more or less as the affinity group.
So this is the groups you're talking about are basically the players in the state, mental health agencies, advocacy groups, people who are concerned about or serve somehow people with mental health disabilities.
Mental health, developmental disabilities, SUD, yes.
So this is $2.4 billion. How has it been spent? Who has been managing that money and the services that go along with it?
The current system has evolved into 10 prepaid inpatient health plans who distribute the Medicaid money to 46 different community mental health programs in the state. Some of them are countywide, some of them are multi-county. But the Medicaid money has gone through those prepaid inpatient health plans to those entities to provide services to the populations that we mentioned. The number of prepaid inpatient health plans was just reduced to 10 from 19 previously, and for efficiencies and because it seemed unwieldy, I think, for there to be 19. The 46 entities that provide mental health services have existed for some time now. And the function of the prepaid inpatient health plans, I think, was to do some of the work the state used to do in terms of administering the money. Mental health programs also get general fund dollars that aren't Medicaid dollars, and they get those separately and not through the prepaid inpatient health plans. So it's a little bit complicated, but the money for providing services to people we care about has typically gone to the community mental health programs, which is the on-the-ground deliverer or buyer of the services.
So why does Governor Snyder want to take it from the plan that exists, as you just described it, and shift it to Medicaid HMOs as he's proposed?
Well, that's the $64,000 or $2.4 billion question. We're not really sure what the motivation of the governor was. On the surface, I believe it was led to believe that it was to reduce some of the overhead, but we really don't know what his motivation is.
So the typical reasons, privatize because it's more efficient and it'll save the state money.
Yeah.
That's what we think.
Okay. So you've had these discussions. You've been involved in them for quite a while now. That larger group has been broken down into smaller groups. Has the Department of Health and Human Services or Lieutenant Governor Calley told you why they want you in smaller groups?
It's a single small group. And the reason we were given for the smaller group in the beginning was to gain more input from more people instead of just the 124 who were in the larger group. That was ostensibly the reason that we were just convened to gain input from additional people around the state, both providers of services and additional people who utilize services.
And that's what today's meeting was about.
Ostensibly, this is the third.
You keep saying that word. What are you hinting at?
What I'm hinting at is that we had some. There's been some disagreement among, especially the advocacy organizations, the people who represent people with disabilities, versus the other members of the group and the leadership from Department of Health and Human Services. There's been some disagreement about what the role ought to be and whether we were going to adhere to the work that was done already out of the 298, the large group. They came up with both values and mission, and they also came up with some specific recommendations or essential elements that needed to be there. And we were not getting, we didn't think, faithful adherence to those.
So you have this set of ideas, a set of goals saying, hey, look, if you're going to make this switch, here are some of the things you really need to be concerned about to make sure that the people who benefit from these funds, the people who need these funds, continue to get the services they require. And there's some concern that that's not being taken seriously by the administration. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's close. But we started from a different position saying we should reimagine what the system looks like and make the best system we can, and then we'll fall out from that whether we should adopt a different kind of funding or using different methodologies. To this point, there's not been anything that we've seen or that we've been through that leads us to believe that the governor's original plan makes any sense, either financially or for any other reason.
So you're taking the opportunity to say, hey, if we're going to look at this, let's really look at this. Let's see how we can make everything work better.
Exactly.
Where are we with this then?
That's the issue. Where are we with it was a bone of contention. Seeking more input just to seek input didn't make any sense to us. So we said, we'll seek more input, but it has to be in line with what we've already decided and with the core values and things we have. We need to ask questions or seek input on how best to implement what we've talked about.
You both feel this way?
Yes. And to go a little further, is our role, our continuing role in this process, is it going to be meaningful or is it going to be window dressing? And we had some concerns about that, and we've had to bat the ball back and forth. But we are cautiously optimistic after the lieutenant governor intervened again yesterday and brought us back to the table today. We're cautiously optimistic that we're back on track.
And I think that when you say we're together in this, there are some 11 organizations who signed on to the email to the governor, lieutenant governor rather, asking for his assistance or letting him know that we were very unhappy with the way it was going. So all of the advocacy organizations, all the organizations representing people with disabilities were absolutely united in this. We've not been pitted against each other in any fashion, nor have we seen any reason to depart from the unity we feel.
I have one quick final question. Cranes reported that Cali has said he's indifferent to who manages the Medicaid mental health funds when he started this work group. Have you found him to be neutral, open-minded about this?
I think so. And I think, to be really candid, I don't think he's bought in any further to the governor's original proposal at all. I think he's relatively open-minded and has taken our recommendations that I don't think would lead in that direction. He's taken them to heart. So I give him a lot of credit for that.
And I would agree.
And do you feel the Department of Health and Human Services is also an honest broker in this?
I have reservations always, having been at this for quite a while. I always have reservations about whether there's a hidden agenda or a second thing somebody wants or what exactly they're pushing for. Once we gave up the notion that the governor was driving this, or his original statements or original budget language was guiding this, that doesn't mean there aren't other things that people want or push for. So a healthy skepticism, I think, is called for.
So, Kevin, I'm going to give you the last word. What do you think? Where do we go from here?
Well, again, I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm really glad that the advocacy community and even representation from the CMH community is united in finding the best solution that best serves our population here in Michigan. Not to start with who's going to administer the $2.4 billion, whether it's the health plans or the CMHs, but how do we utilize this opportunity to reimagine the system to best deliver mental health care services and services to persons living with developmental disability and SUD issues. That's where we are.
Kevin Fisher is president of National Alliance on Mental Illness Michigan and Don Hoyle, director of public policy of the ARC. Gentlemen, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Up next, we'll talk about Michigan's sex offender registry and why new laws shouldn't be applied to people already on the list. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that laws regarding Michigan's sex offender registry cannot be applied retroactively. We're going to get into that a little bit, but before we begin, a note of warning. The topic we're about to explore might be disturbing to some listeners and not suitable for young listeners. Joining us is University of Michigan Professor of Law J.J. Prescott. He's an expert on sex offender laws. Tell us what this ruling is about. What does it do?
Sure. So what this law does is essentially forbid the state of Michigan from applying the sex offender registry and related laws to people who were convicted or released prior to the enactment of the law. For a long time, these laws have been claimed to be regulatory, which means they aren't really about punishing people for past crimes. They're about trying to keep people who have done something in the past from hurting people today. The Smith versus Doe case, which was a Supreme Court case in 2003, declared that registries, sex offender registries, are regulatory, not punitive, and therefore the ex post facto restriction of our Constitution does not apply to them. The real move here, the difference about this case, is that since that time, registration and the other obligations, including residency and loitering restrictions, have just gotten so much more severe that the move here was to say that was a first-generation registry law. Fine, that may have been regulatory, but it is no longer regulatory. It is now punitive. The concern here is we had Smith versus Doe. Certain things were allowed, but states should not think of that as a blank check to keep bashing on sex offenders. They have to really mean these laws to regulate and to protect the people. And what they're doing now, there's no evidence that it works. In fact, evidence that it's counterproductive. And it starts to look a little fishy when, after all these years, no evidence that it works, some evidence that it actually may hurt, and we keep expanding and doubling down in this area. And when you keep doubling down in an area where there's no sign there's any upsides from a policy perspective, you start to think this is really about going after a small group of people who don't have the kinds of protections. And that's exactly what the counter-majoritarian ex post facto constitutional provision is really about. It's about making sure that majorities, when they suddenly start to get angry at some group or passionate about some issue, can't just go off and railroad particular parts of our society.
The sex offender registry is really popular. A lot of people visit that, monitor it, keep tabs on people moving into the neighborhood, you know, just in case. It makes people feel safer. So why shouldn't we have everybody on that sex offender registry if they've been convicted of a crime in the past?
So it's certainly the case that sex offender registries are popular. It's easy for a politician to support them. But there are a few reasons to doubt whether or not they actually are something you should care about. And that's that evidence is increasingly indicating that they don't affect the likelihood that people recidivate. And in fact, if anything, the evidence suggests that it goes the other way.
So they're not going to be repeat offenders, generally speaking, because of this registry?
Well, the typical sex offender is not like what people imagine. Let's say somebody who jumps out of the bushes or a child molester. There's a small fraction of people who fall into that category. But as in the case of the plaintiffs in this case, that's not the standard case.
What other people are on that list? I've understand that if you were 18 and your boyfriend was 17 and you were convicted of statutory rape, you're on that registry for a long, long time, even if it was consensual.
That's right.
That if you're convicted of a misdemeanor, that you could be on that list for a long, long time.
That's right. So there are consensual crimes. In fact, one of the plaintiffs in this case, you know, had sex with somebody who was underage. That person happened to be underage but also at a club for 18-year-olds and older when they met. They're actually married, as I understand it now today, and have a family. And even so, this person is on the registry. Depending on where you are and which state, it can be crimes as minor as public urination. Lots of crimes that seem sexual in nature or kind of weird but don't suggest violence or involve a clear victim, then that's, you know, one of the problems here. In addition, a lot of the crimes that people were convicted of didn't know that this was how they were going to be treated later on. So, for example, one of the plaintiffs actually was a juvenile or went through a juvenile-type sentencing program, and in order to have his record sealed, agreed to a particular charge. And at that time, the charge didn't have any of these consequences. And so lo and behold, later on, even though part of the arrangement was that he would, you know, have his record sealed, he's now publicly listed on the sex offender registry.
What's the impact of that to an individual?
Yeah, that takes us back to the main question here, which is how is it possible that something that seems so intuitively likely to make us safer can actually make us much worse off? And the answer is, when you're thinking about what causes somebody to commit a crime, it may be that if a few people in your neighborhood know you're a sex offender, that it might stop you from doing something that you otherwise might be. That's the claim people make. But you also have to realize all of the collateral consequences that these people suffer. So they can't find jobs. They can't build relationships. They can't establish families. They can't live near their families in a lot of situations. They wind up paying, often even though they're unemployed, for some of the registration that they have to comply with. And as a result, they're poor, they're homeless, they're friendless. A lot of times you'll see comments from people who live under these registries, and they basically say, my life has been taken from me. I have nothing. Ask yourself, if you have nothing, you also have nothing to lose. And so when you're thinking about somebody who's trying to get on the straight and narrow, who has committed a crime in the past, has gone to jail for the time that the judge indicated they had to go to jail for, and is now back out trying to rebuild their life, and they suddenly realize, I'm on this registry for the rest of my life. There's no coming back from this.
That's a lifelong house arrest.
And the court in this decision points that out, that much of how this works actually looks like punishment. But in terms of the policy decision here, leaving aside the law, if you really have nothing to lose, threatening somebody with sending them back to prison isn't all that effective.
Now, I got to tell you, I'd never been on the site until today in prepping for this interview, and I looked at a one-mile radius within the radio station here, the address of the radio station, and there were 41 people listed, but I have no idea how dangerous they are. It doesn't list whether they were convicted of being a child molester or a rapist. It doesn't really say what their crime was. So how do you tell whether this is a real threat to the safety of people I love or not?
So that has been a recurrent complaint about these websites and notification approaches since the beginning. They get the information out there technically, but you might have to be a lawyer to interpret what it means or spend a lot of time investigating it. So a couple of problems. One, we have so many people on the registry now that people who aren't really dangerous are mixed in with people who might be dangerous. So the 41 people near the station, for example, maybe there are two or three you really ought to know about, but how do you pick them out of the crowd? This is one of the problems with expanding the registry. On top of that, there could be a lot of improvement in the kind of information it conveys. So it might say something like CSC, criminal sexual conduct, and not really tell you what that was or what the facts were. And some of that's about trying to protect the victim, who might be easier to identify if you give more of the facts, but it also makes it much harder for users to make use of.
This law in itself, this registry in itself, has been called constitutionally vague. There's some questions about whether this should be done because, as you mentioned earlier, it might be punishment rather than, you know, just a follow-up and keeping track. We don't keep track of murderers or people who have done violent crimes of other kinds in the way we do sex offenders. So what kind of changes to the sex offender registry do you think would be appropriate and why?
Yeah, so if we start with the presumption that there are some released sex offenders out there who are really dangerous, I think that the most important thing we could do is really move to, you know, a risk assessment type of approach. So the way the law currently works is it looks at the conviction you had, maybe the conviction you had 30 years ago, and asks, do you fall into a particular category? It doesn't ask whether or not you're elderly now. It doesn't ask whether or not you have succeeded in treatment. It doesn't do anything like that. And so an obvious first step would be moving towards an individualized assessment of each of these potential sex offenders. The laws themselves are incredibly onerous. You know, there's almost a natural sort of who cares if it's hard on the sex offender? If they're potentially dangerous, why should we care whether or not it's really tough for them to come in and register, whether we charge them for doing it? And part of the answer is in order for these people to really reintegrate into society and to be productive members who are employed and pay taxes, who build families, who really are the people that you want to be in your communities, you got to not just make it difficult for difficult's sake.
J.J. Prescott is a University of Michigan law professor. He was cited as an expert in the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling last week regarding Michigan's sex offender registry. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. MLive recently published an in-depth look at Michigan's public colleges and how they subsidize sports with tuition dollars. A shout out to Paula Gardner and Brian McVicker for some solid reporting. What stood out more than anything else to me is the fact that among the schools that offer NCAA-level athletics, collectively, Western Michigan, Eastern Michigan, and Central Michigan spend more tuition dollars on sports than all the other 10 public universities combined. It's costing Western nearly $26 million a year. At Eastern, the subsidy is more than $27 million a year, which amounts to 10% of the tuition bill. So how does that compare to the state's big schools? Michigan State subsidizes athletics a bit over $700,000 a year. Michigan, $263,000. Joining us now is Richard Vetter. He's a professor of economics at Ohio University and the director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. I've talked to Eastern Michigan University's athletic director about this on this program before, and I still can't understand how a school can spend so much money subsidizing athletics, whether the football team is a chronic loser or a winning team, such as Central, to a lesser degree Western. I guess I say football because that's where most of the money goes, right? So how does any of this make sense?
Well, to me, it doesn't, Lester. It's interesting that the schools in the state that have the greatest reputation, both academically and athletically, among the public universities, the University of Michigan, of course, in Ann Arbor, and Michigan State, are the ones that are relatively subsidy-free. It isn't that their athletic programs are small. Indeed, they're much larger than those at Western or Eastern or Central. It's that they have commercial value associated with them. People want to watch football at the University of Michigan. In fact, 110,000 people will show up at the stadium, whereas at Eastern Michigan, if there are 10,000 people in the stadium, it's considered a remarkable achievement. And the reason, you know, the two schools are 6 miles apart, Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti. You can walk from one to the other or take a bicycle easily. There is not enough market for the entertainment provided by these secondary schools in an athletic conference, the Mid-America Conference, that is sort of a wannabe Big Ten level schools. This is true in Michigan. It's true in the other states in the Mid-America Conference, such as Illinois or Ohio, where I'm at. My university, Ohio University, played at Eastern Michigan about 3 years ago, and there were allegedly 3,000 people in the stands. But I am told by my friends who were there that there were probably really 1,000. At the same time, there are 110,000 people sitting in Ann Arbor, 6 miles away. Does that make any sense at all? I don't think so.
Well, you've done some research about how much people view the academics at a school positively, in part because of a school's success on the field. So tell us a little bit about that. They associate good sports playing with good academics. End of story.
Well, there are schools. You know, I do the rankings of colleges and universities for Forbes magazine, and our rankings are similar to the U.S. News rankings. Stanford University ranks very, very high in both rankings as an academic institution. But Stanford isn't bad at football either. They're pretty darn good. Notre Dame is high in both the academic side and the athletic side. So you say, well, there's a great relationship there. But then you look at MIT. I think MIT, do they have teams that play? Maybe. I don't know. The relationship between academics and athletics, there is some relationship there, but it is modest. And given the cost of sports, $25, $27, $28 million, what is that? $1,100 a student at Eastern, I think. That's 10%, 15% of the tuition level.
Yeah, it's 10%. I have to have personal knowledge of that right now.
Oh, yeah.
So at Grand Valley State University, in this MLive article, the former retired athletic director said, quote, "We believe our students pay a lot of money at Grand Valley. We don't want to charge a lot more because our egos say we should be Division I. Grand Valley plays Division II. But Eastern and Western, whose students pay twice as much for athletics as Grand Valley State students do, stay with Division I because, well, they say they have to, that it makes sense, that it's prestigious and it makes a big difference." Now, at least Western has racked up some winning seasons. We're not talking about schools that are in the big, powerful conferences like U of M and MSU. Does anyone pay attention to that Division I category when it's MAC, and is it worth the price of the students pay for it?
No, I quite agree with the sentiment of what you're asking. The Division I actually is divided into a couple subdivisions. There's a football, in effect, a major league and a minor league within Division I, and the Mid-America Conference schools are aspiring to be at the top of the major leagues, and they're really in the minor leagues. There are five strong athletic conferences in the United States with about 65 schools in them, and then there's another several dozen other Division I-A schools that just don't quite make that top level. And that's where Eastern, Western, and Central are. Michigan State make that top division. There's just not enough market for more than 60 or 65 teams to play games that will attract millions of people, that the TV networks will pay millions and millions to get the rights to broadcast, that people will pay $50, $75 for a football game. Almost no one would pay $50 to go to watch a football game in Ypsilanti. And the tragedy of it is the kids that go to Eastern Michigan and Western Michigan are not as well off economically as the kids that go to Ann Arbor. The kids that go to Ann Arbor, the Pell Grant percentage of kids at Pell Grants at Ann Arbor are less than half of what it is at Eastern. The Pell Grants are the kids who are relatively modest income. There are more modest income kids going to Eastern Michigan, percentage-wise, than to the University of Michigan. Yet kids of the University of Michigan pay no subsidy to speak of, just a nominal subsidy for sports, $10 a student or something, whereas at Eastern Michigan they're paying over $1,100, $1,200 a year, and that's like a cruel tax, a very regressive tax.
You're saying the kids at Eastern pay 100 times the fee for athletics as the kids at University of Michigan?
Absolutely.
What do you think of the idea that universities would be required to tell parents and students right there on the bill how much of their tuition money is going toward these subsidies for athletics?
I think it should be mandated. I think it's a great idea. The state of Virginia has recently put a limit on the amount that that can be used to subsidize sports from student fees and university revenues. And I think some sort of a restraint should be put on. And one way to do it is exactly your idea. Put it on the bill and shame the schools. Because in most cases, the parents and the students don't even know this. They're not aware of the extent. They know there's some subsidy there, but they're not aware of the extent of it.
Richard Vedder is an economist and the director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity at Ohio University. Thanks very much for talking with us.
I'm glad to be with you.
Just a note, the University of Michigan disputes the NCAA's numbers, saying that no money comes out of its general fund to support athletics. We'll check that out. Stateside's producers are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. The executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.